This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertz, the General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every show here on The Orb, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, it's been a long time since we've been paid a visit by the owls.
It is, and I gotta say, Chris, the mess is ridiculous. It's everywhere. This is why, you know, they stopped using them at the Ministry of Magic, and just started using those nice floating paper airplanes. We've got to find a new way to get the orbs delivered through our mailbox because, when they show up on the station, Quark has a fit.
He really does. And so does O'Brien, because he has to get his crew together to go clean everything up.
And I got to tell you, you would not believe how hard it is to get that stuff off of everything. I mean, we're talking like promenade chairs. We're talking about off the paint, off the hull. I mean, it's just Worf throws a hissy fit if it lands on the Defiant's, you know, nameplate on the outside. It's just it's awful. But I'm just glad we get so much mail. So, you know.
Oh man, I'm just picturing like when you walk outside and a bird has visited your car.
Yeah.
But on a much larger scale, that it's so large that it's covering an entire letter on the hull of the Defiant. Now, is massive.
Let me give you a just a little thought process here. So I lived in Minnesota for 4 years while I was in grad school. And in that, the Canadian geese would come through twice a year. So just imagine the amount of geese that come through. And yeah, this is not a little bird, so imagine finding that everywhere all the time for about 3 weeks. That's kind of what we're talking about.
Well, I know that very well because I lived in Reno, Nevada, and in the southern part of Reno where I lived, we also had the Canadian geese who came through, and same problem. All right, so why are we talking about owls? Well, if you're a listener to The Orb, you know that it's time for The Orb of Mail. Because Matthew loves Harry Potter so much, we have our mail delivered by Owl Post here on The Orb. And for now, we are going to continue on with the owls, who have brought us a lot of mail. Because I didn't realize this, Matthew, but it's been a long time. It was end of November, the last time that we did an Orb of Mail. We typically do 5 or 6 episodes between these shows, but we used to be weekly, and so it wasn't such a long period of time. And because of my work schedule, which is becoming famous around the network, I know, we have not been recording The Orb as frequently, and so a lot of time has passed, and that means that we have a lot of messages from our listeners. So
I kind of feel like what it must feel like to be Santa, you know, when he gets all that mail delivered to him finally, and it's just bags and bags of mail.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it feels like.
So the question is, can you go to the post office and just write Chris and Matt, The Orb, and put a stamp on it and drop it in, and will it get to us?
I mean, if you can't, you should be able to.
We need to work on that.
Yeah. I'm going to vote for whoever for president will make that happen.
Okay. Not sure who that'll be, but all right. Well, let's jump on in here with the messages. So first of all, if you sent us a message a long time ago and you've never heard us talk about it on the air, please listen on because we're going to cover those old messages here. And we do apologize for the delay. And the first one is from Kyle Charlton in Vancouver, Washington.
Hey, that's where I'm from, Mal.
That's right. He's a local guy for you, Matthew. And Kyle writes, I just finished listening to your podcast, Admiral Denorius and his ginormous belt buckle. And classic. While Matt was talking about how Sisko might have influenced the prophets to get involved with corporeal life, it dawned on me that Sisko and Odo might have something in common. What if Sisko was created by the prophets not only to fulfill his role as emissary, but also as a means to learn more about corporeal life, much in the same way Odo was sent out by the founders to learn and explore? So what are your thoughts, Matthew?
I think this is great. You know, the more and more I think about this whole idea of Sisko, the Sisko at this point, as we're talking about him, he has this kind of predestination paradox about his life. You know, that he meets the prophets and then they in turn make sure he's born. But of course, they're outside of time. So that's really not a circle at all. And what I love about that is they realize how necessary he is to them as a race. And I think that's really a fascinating look at these aliens who, before this happened, seemed to be very much in and of themselves. You know, they're all about themselves, and that it is this run-in with this man named Benjamin Sisko that kind of changes their whole perspective on the universe and opens them up to a whole new world that they hadn't seemed to experience before this, and it makes for a great kind of amazing meta story that's going on with all of this. And, you know, the godlike nature that they have, and yet they're closed off in their own, you know, kind of spiritual realm, and they are impacted by the actions of a human being. It's just, the more and more you start to think about it, the crazier and cooler it gets. And so I love this idea. And it does seem very similar in some ways to the way that Odo is sent off. And yeah, they want to learn more about corporeal beings, and they're using this, you know, these parts of themselves as the founders to go off to learn and then come home. And so it almost is kind of like that. So yeah, it's really cool.
Well, I can see in the case of Odo that the founders had encounters with solids, and they wanted to learn more about them, and so they created the 100 and they sent them out. But this is, of course, a linear thing, right? It would be like if we had an encounter with some alien race and we wanted to know more about them, and then we sent people out to infiltrate them. But in the case of the prophets, it becomes more interesting because, and we talked about this recently because another listener had brought this up, the fact that Sisko may have been created to be the emissary in order to allow the prophet's plans to work out. Like, they needed him, so they went back in time, essentially, though not through time travel, because there is no time for them. So they just, at that point when he needed to be born, they made sure that he was conceived. But you could also look at it as the prophets having the encounters that they have with the Bajorans and with other corporeal beings, and history basically playing out for us and then rewinding and then playing forward again, but this time with Sisko there, because the prophets realized that they needed him. And then it would be like their alternate timelines, you know? So maybe there is a timeline where Sisko doesn't exist for the prophets and things played out differently. And they realized they needed him. They needed to learn more about corporeal beings and linear time. And so they created him, kind of what Kyle is saying here, as I take it. So yeah, it's certainly possible. It's one of the interesting things about the DS9 storyline, that they really do leave so much open and so much there for you to interpret how you want.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that, you know, good Star Trek did, which was leave some things open to the interpretation of the audience. And you know, Deep Space Nine was very good at some of that, especially with the more metaphysical nature of the series. There was some of it that was just left up to the imagination of the watcher. And that's mm-hmm. cool. You know, not everything has to be, you know, super explained and in nitty gritty detail. This is where it makes it more fun to be able to kind of speculate and really like, oh man, I wonder, you know, and then yada, yada, yada. And that's what we've gotten, you know, over doing this show for so many years now. Come to some really interesting things that are in my head canon now that weren't years ago just because of all the conversations.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's go on to the next letter. And this one is from Linda Hutton in California. Linda writes, congrats on 100 shows. Excellent podcast. I share your love of Deep Space Nine, and I really enjoyed your podcast about the ship. I'm going to have to watch it again now. I saw someone's tweet the other day saying that whoever invented the character of Vic Fontaine should be shot. What a short-sighted comment from a monumentally closed-minded individual. Without Vic, Nog may never have survived his PTSD after losing his leg. There's just so much to appreciate about DS9 and so many aspects of it that invoke deep thought and introspection. Compared to all the other iterations of Trek, I refer to DS9 as Star Trek for grown-ups. For anyone who wants more than just a surface observation of human nature and acceptance of different cultures, races, and species, then DS9 is the series to study. Thank you for your dedication to Deep Space Nine, the best Star Trek series ever created. And she is on Twitter, I take it, as TrekLady11. Well, Linda, you're preaching to the choir here, first of all, with this.
I was just about to be like, preach it, sister.
Matthew's
Hallelujah.
Snapping his fingers over here. But, I mean, I would say that, I mean, of course, we agree with you in terms of the depth of the writing on DS9. About Vic Fontaine, I mean, I'm not surprised that someone would tweet that. I think that, again, those are viewers who aren't really considering the character interactions in Star Trek and the family of DS9 and just the story that the writers are trying to tell. Vic Fontaine, talking about Nog and his leg and his PTSD, absolutely. We talked about that recently. Well, I guess on the Ready Room we did It's Only a Paper Moon. Mm-hmm. A couple yep. of months ago. So we talked about it there. And of course, we've talked about it here on The Orb. But that's just one of the many things that would be different about DS9 and just one of the ways that Vic Fontaine changed the lives of our characters for the better.
You know, one of the things that is so crucial, I think, about this is what you were just saying about how the series of Deep Space Nine is really about the family that is created by these characters, and it is about so much the characters. And I think that I would argue that that is a departure for Star Trek. Star Trek is not usually about the characters, it's usually about the story happening to the characters,
right?
But not necessarily just about the characters themselves, whereas this series is so much about these characters and these interpersonal relationships. And I mean, really shot? I mean, Vic Fontaine, just think about this, is a great Star Trek exploration of the idea of a sentient life form that is a hologram that knows he's one in a way that is much more, I think, interesting and more ready for me to buy than just like, say, the Doctor. And can that kind of program really, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's such an interesting thought process to go through with yeah. the character. And so even if maybe you don't necessarily like the character, the actual science and the science fiction of it is actually pretty genius.
Yeah, it is. And now don't get us wrong. We like the Doctor, at least I like the Doctor. He's one of my favorite characters on Voyager, but the Doctor was created for a specific purpose and has the knowledge of all the Doctors in Starfleet's history in order to do his job. And is put in a situation where he has to serve as an officer. He has a duty. And then he grows through that. But Vic Fontaine is a little bit different in that, you know, he's just a character that was created who was given special capabilities and grew through his interactions with the crew, but on a not on a professional level. You know, he's not there to serve the ship. He's just there to do his thing. So he's a little bit different. And the technology behind it is really fascinating. On the character level, moving beyond Nog, Odo and Kira probably would have never gotten together without Vic Fontaine.
Very true.
Also, Sisko himself, I think, was loosened up a bit by Vic Fontaine, because Sisko, we know from the beginning of the series, you know, he had this love of music in him. You see him singing while he's cooking, you know, he's just, he's from New Orleans, so obviously he's going to love jazz. And Vic Fontaine gave him the opportunity to come in and kind of relax in some tense situations. And I would also say that the setting that Vic Fontaine provides to Sisko and the crew allows them all to bond a little bit more. If you look at the Enterprise, you know, all good things, the series ends with Picard finally coming in and sitting down at the poker table. That environment just kind of created this sort of, it's not division per se, but it's just everything's buttoned up, right? You're on the starship. You've got to stay formal all the time. And they didn't do things as a group, as a crew, in quite the same way that they did on DS9. And it was largely thanks to Vic Fontaine's program that they had the opportunity and the place to go do that together, something that everyone enjoyed. So, such an important character to the show. And it's just hard to believe that anyone watching Star Trek who's really thinking about what they're watching would even say that the person who created Vic Fontaine should be shot.
Well, and just think about this, you know, it's there's a sense of whimsy and fun to it.
Yeah.
You know, we don't think of our characters really as having a lot of fun, you know, but what I love about Deep Space Nine is you actually kind of see the things to which these 24th century characters do in their off time. And, you know, harkening back to something old is classic for the Deep Space Nine crew. You know, Sisko loves baseball. O'Brien and Bashir really love this, these old holodeck programs that are putting in these big battles and things like that, or in a time period that seems almost wistful by their standards, you know, where they are, especially by the time when they're at the war. And, yeah, you know, all of these things are giving you an opportunity to see how these characters look and feel when they're not on duty, I think is really cool. And, you know, this was just a great program for them to be able to do that in. And again, Vic turned out to be a fun, vibrant character at a time when things could have been too dark if something like this hadn't been introduced. And so I think this, like you said, helps lighten up somebody like Sisko, but the whole crew and the whole show is enlightened by the joy they get from these small things in the midst of a really terrible war.
Yeah. And I think for me, again, because I'm a musician and I love jazz, the injection of this character in the jazz setting into the show itself added this extra little dash of life to the show that really helped set it apart from the rest of Star Trek as well. So, so thank you very much, Linda, for your letter. And let's go on to the next one. This is from Sam Piasek in Singapore. Sam is an associate producer on my show, The Ready Room, in fact. And Sam writes, one thing to consider in analyzing Worf's decision to try and ram the cube in First Contact is that the Defiant has, in all the tech companions, a warhead module in its nose. Not sure what that means, but assuming it's highly explosive. Perhaps he took this into account when deciding if he had a chance to really destroy the cube by sacrificing his ship, thus making a potentially wise Worf decision. So this goes back to our recent show on First Contact, and I think I made the comment perhaps that it didn't make sense for Worf to try to ram the cube because there's no way that he would actually destroy the ship. And I think that, Matthew, you may have said something like, well, maybe there's a breach, like a warp core breach or something, and it works. But I think the point that Sam makes here is interesting, but the problem with it is that this information is not established anywhere on screen, and therefore it's not something that a fan, a viewer, can really consider in their assessment of what's happening in the film.
Talk about explosively blowing your nose. I mean, geez. I completely agree with you. I don't really have too much to add in that because, you know, something like that has to have been established somewhere in canon or in the movie itself. And it would actually need to be in the movie because you can't expect everybody.
Well, it could have been on the series. Like, if we knew from the series that there was this module in the nose of the Defiant, then at least Deep Space Nine fans watching the film could say, oh, well, maybe he's going to use that. Although non-DS9 fans watching the film, which is probably the majority of the fans watching the film in the theater, would not have that knowledge still.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's an interesting thought, and who knows? I think that the point of that scene is to make a good Klingon decision for Worf to go down fighting in the best way possible and to do all he can to cripple the ship as much as possible, especially if the ship is about to be, for all intents and purposes, useless. You know, so they're defending Earth. So you do everything you can, and you and your ship are expendable at that point. So Worf is making the only tactical decision he has left fighting this enemy. And you can't really fault him for that. But yeah, as to whether it's a warhead or not, I definitely think we would have had to establish that somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. I will say, from a design standpoint, it does make sense to put a warhead module in the nose of the Defiant, since the ship was designed purely as a warship in the first place. So as a last-ditch effort, you could ram an enemy, yes.
But what happens if you accidentally just bump something in space with that nose? I mean, you know how...
You're in traffic and you just accidentally bump into the ship in front of you.
Exactly. Yeah. Or somebody's a little bit overzealous pulling out of Deep Space Nine, you know, and you just clip something. I mean, do you blow up the ship on accident? I mean, so I'm really worried about this idea of it having a warhead in such an unprotected area. I mean, we already have the bridge of every ship on top of the ship. So now we're just going to put a warhead at the front of the ship. Don't hit that.
Well, hopefully it would be something that is not activated until you give the command. I don't know.
Let's hope so.
I hope. All right. So let's go on to the next one. Rich O'Donnell in Sector 001. So that narrows it down a little bit for us. Rich writes, "Hey guys, really enjoy your podcast. Your commentary is insightful and of consistently high quality. I'm really enjoying your series on Worf's transition from TNG to DS9. Regarding Generations, you discussed Worf's familiarity with the old Klingon bird of prey and whether his knowledge of its weakness was something any chief of security would know, or if it stemmed from his personal interest in all things Klingon. In my mind, this knowledge was not simply from studying technical manuals in his free time, but rather something he would have learned as a direct result of his participation in the Klingon Civil War in Redemption Parts 1 and 2. Making the connection even stronger is the involvement of the Duras sisters in Generations. The House of Duras was a major player in the Civil War and direct adversaries of Worf. So I viewed his knowledge of their ship as much more personal than something recalled from an obscure technical report. Thanks again for the great podcast and this great series of episodes. Looking forward to the rest. Rich O'Donnell." All right, Matthew, what are your thoughts?
Well, this is an interesting one. I think that Worf does have a lot of time with the Klingons. When we do think about the history of TNG, you know, they really do set up, and the Enterprise always seem to be involved with the Klingons. And so I do think he makes a great point. There are a lot of other places that he has had experience. You know, he's been on Klingon ships himself with the exchange program, things like that. And of course, with Redemption. So he has a lot of firsthand knowledge, along with, I'm sure, all the study that he probably put in, just because it's Worf and he wanted to be a Klingon. So I think, you know, from the early age, you know, as a child, he's probably doing that as well. So you put all that together and you get a really well-rounded Klingon who may know actually more about the Klingon defense fleet and its tactical nature than even some Klingons who are just nominally in, you know, their fleet position. They could care less. They're just there to get free blood wine.
Is that why they joined? Free blood wine?
Well, I mean,
wine.
That's why I joined, I know, so.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a combination of the two. I think it's, as Rich says here, the fact that he did spend a lot of time on Klingon ships, and so he would have learned about the systems. It's one of those leaps you have to make where I think it's often the case with fans that we take what we see on screen as being all there is that's happening in the lives of these characters. And what we have to remember is that the stories that we see, it's like we're dipping into their lives for a moment here and a moment there, right? Because let's take TNG, for example, where they're going on all these different missions and they're visiting all these different planets. If 7 years of your life was as continuously action-packed and life-threatening as that, that would be a very difficult life, right? So we have to remember that there's a lot of other time in between everything that's going on. And so we don't know what all Worf did when he was with the Klingon Defense Force in Redemption. You know, we don't know what he's done other times either. You know, maybe there are times when he's visited Klingon ships in between missions that we see. So I think it's a really good point, Rich. And I think it's a combination of the two, though, because I do think as a tactical officer, he probably does study the enemy ships and schematics. It's, you know, part of his job. So let's go on, Matthew, to the next one. Philip Gunther in Sydney, Australia writes, by the way, I love that we're getting letters from all over the planet here.
Yeah, it's
today.
Pretty awesome. Thought that people listen to the orb all around the orb. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So Philip writes, guys, while I generally loved the Orb 101, Essential DS9 Season 1, and I'm very much looking forward to your take on the other seasons, I was shocked that you found the episode, If Wishes Were Horses, to be non-essential. After all, it is where Sisko's baseball originates. Arguably, it also is the first episode where Sisko's love for baseball in general is focused upon. Given that the baseball will come to play an important role in future episodes, just think about its significance as a silent promise to Dukat when the station changes hands that Sisko will be back, or when Dukat hands it over to Sisko in tacit acknowledgement of defeat in Sacrifice of Angels, or the countless times when Sisko throws the baseball in the air and fondles it when he mulls things up. Interesting choice of words there. So I must call fail on that one. Otherwise, I was pretty happy with your choices. Keep it up, Philip. This one's interesting, Matthew, because I don't know if Philip wrote this while he was in the middle of listening to the episode or not, because at the end of the episode, we do come back around and we do put If Wishes Were Horses in as one of our wild cards, specifically because of the baseball, because I brought it up at the end saying that, well, actually, I told you there's a very important character who's introduced in that episode, and you paused for a bit thinking about it, and then baseball.
Yeah, and you would have thought I would have got that since I have one on my desk.
That's right, you do, yes.
Yeah.
Which you often fondle as we record the orb, I must say.
Well, I wouldn't have chosen those words, Chris, but let's just move right along. I think I remember when we talked about that one, and it was just a tough call. And honestly, for both you and I, we both enjoy that episode. And so in our rewatches, it is essential.
Yeah.
So for all intents and purposes, that wild card for me just kind of meant, yes, it's essential.
Yeah.
Per the rules of the game.
That's the thing. Yeah.
It was the way we were rating it. And it was definitely something that was hard for us. I mean, we had to go back and forth a lot. So it's definitely not a slight against the episode at all. It was just more that, okay, what really does get introduced in the episode? And yeah, you know, I mean, that's a good argument. The baseball, it really is the best argument for saying that it's essential. So,
yeah. Well, I will say that, as you said, per the rules of the game, that episode is very borderline, because when we do these essential episodes, and this originated on To the Journey, our Voyager show. So Tristan and Char are the experts at this, and we're kind of learning as we go along. But it's what's truly essential that if you don't see it, the rest of the series will not work for you. And I would still argue that while the baseball adds a wonderful level of depth to the story and the interaction between Sisko and Dukat, if you don't know where the baseball came from, it still does not prevent you from understanding its symbolism when it is traded back and forth between Sisko and Dukat. And so I'm putting it, as we did using a wild card, we did make it an essential element, but it's definitely borderline. But it is one of my favorite moments. And I always enjoyed that episode just in general. It's just kind of a fun episode, I think. But once we got to the end of the series and we found out how important that baseball was, it added even more meaning for me for If Wishes Were Horses. Okay, Matthew, next up, we're going international again from Bristol in the UK. Ty Singh writes, "Hi guys, loving the show, especially the tenuous links about how they got Worf back into the TNG films. It was while I was rewatching Generations that I was again struck that the production uses the same shot of Chang's Bird of Prey blowing up in Star Trek VI for Lursa and Bator's Bird of Prey blowing up in Generations. Now, for a major film, this is incredibly cheap, especially for a film that directly follows the one you're ripping off. But this got me thinking about how this happened in DS9, especially the final series during the Dominion War. Now, battle scenes aren't cheap, and to make them exciting, you must assume that none of the starship's shields are working, so they explode all over the place. But in the DS9 finale, I was shocked to see them reuse shot after shot from battles we'd seen before. The battle to retake DS9, and the battle of the Chentaka system. For the finale of the show, I was devastated to see the production do something so cheap, as we see the same old Miranda-class vessels blow up and the same shots we'd seen previously used, as if we wouldn't notice. I was wondering whether you guys planned to do an episode on the space battles of DS9 and ask the question, if you're going to do a war arc, save some budget for the battles. For me, this has always taken away from the bombastic nature of the finale. The heart is still there, but that inherent cheapness always distracts. Keep up the good work, Ty." Okay, so I've got a lot of things to say about this one. First of all, I really don't like the use of the term cheapness here, because the studio is not being cheap. They're doing what they have to do in order to tell a story. It's incredibly difficult to balance a budget on a TV show and do all the things that you need to do, especially when you're doing something on such a grandiose scale as what they did with those final 10 hours of DS9. But before I share some of my other thoughts, Matthew, what do you think about this?
Well, no, I agree with you, Chris. You do have to realize that CGI at this point is more expensive. And so that still takes a lot of money. And at that time, it also takes a lot of computing power, to which costs a lot of money and time. To be able to pump out those kind of shots that we consider to be, I mean, that somebody could probably do on their Mac at home these days in less time than it took them then, but maybe at the same quality or better. It's just, you just really have to realize what they're up against. And I think there is an aspect of specifically the finale where you might hope to see that battle, but I don't think that's what that episode's about. I think the fact that the limitation of the budget at that point, because they had had such a massive season, they are forced to really drive at the heart of what the episode is about, and it's about all the character moments. It's not about a big battle, and so it's about the fallout after the big battle, because we already have, as we mentioned here, we've seen some big battles with the retaking Deep Space Nine, the Chentaka system. There's no really, I don't think there's a reason to try and repeat that, and so therefore I don't see it as a cheap decision. I see it as a wise decision to do what you need to do to tell the best story for the end. And the best story for the end of Deep Space Nine is not about spectacle, but it's about character.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I would argue that the entire war, the whole war arc itself, and not even the finale arc, but the whole war, it's not about space battles. It's, as you just said, it's about the characters. It's about how this war that's waging around them affects their lives. And so you don't need the big battles, really. Now, it's great that they did include some battles because it ramps up the danger and gets the adrenaline going a bit for the viewer. But again, it's not the core of what the story is about. Now, Star Trek has a long history of reusing effects. So it's not like for the finale of DS9, they just decided, we're going to use these explosions that we've already used. No one will notice. Yeah, they're not, you know, the viewers aren't that smart. They're not going to pay any attention. It's not like that at all. You can go all through Star Trek from the original series forward, and you're going to see things reused in every series because it's just what you have to do in order to keep the budget of the show under control. And the visual effects guys would love to do new stuff every time, but the studio won't let them do that.
Well, I do have to say that there are only three times. There is a valid point here. There are only three times with which the studio, the movie studio, ponied up the money to make a film of significant scale.
Yeah.
And that is the motion picture, and it shows, and Star Trek 09, and Star Trek Into Darkness. And I'm sure that once we get Star Trek Beyond, we'll see that same thing. And that is because there is a big difference to how movies are made as to when the TOS movies specifically are being made, and even the Next Generation movies, where you can really get away with some stuff. Today, we just don't respond to that. And there is a frustration every time you're watching the movies, and you can tell that the studio is keeping the budget at a certain amount. They're not really wanting to spend a ton of money with Star Trek. They're just trying to make as much off as they can. I can understand at that point when you want to say that there maybe is some cheapness going on with the studio instead of truly investing in something, you're just trying to make a buck. I can see that happening. Luckily, most of the, at least the original series films, I tend to like those, all of them. One through six. So, for the most part, and I can rewatch them, enjoy them. But I think it's a little bit more obvious in the TNG films when they didn't really put the cash in that they should have. I think it especially shows in Insurrection, as we talked about that.
But the interesting thing there, Matthew, is that Insurrection had a considerably larger budget than First Contact.
See, that's so weird, because maybe it's just because the effects were done by ILM,
yeah,
and the effects weren't done by ILM for Insurrection, and you can just tell there's a huge difference in the quality of work that you got.
Yeah.
And maybe it's because, too, the model work, it's a model, the Enterprise E is a model in the First Contact movie, and it's not an Insurrection, so it really, it's a huge difference there, and whereas in Insurrection, it doesn't look real at all. First Contact, everything did. And so, yeah, it is about you get what you pay for in effects and what effects house does the work, you know? And, mm-hmm. You know, you can tell, I have a good friend of mine now that I met through the network who works for ILM, and I know the work that they kind of put in. The people at Weta, if you've watched any of the Lord of the Rings documentaries, you know the work these guys put in to creating this kind of stuff. And, you know, that's why they're the top dogs in their field, why people want to go to them to do their huge films, whether it's Captain America, you know, or, you know, Batman v Superman. So, There's a point here. I think with the show, it's not as I wouldn't agree with it. With the films, you have more of a valid point.
Yeah, with Generations, they could have done a new explosion. So that's true.
Yeah, they really could. I mean, that is the same explosion that we've been watching. That, you know, Bird of Prey blow up for a long time. So
my thing here is that I think with the DS9 finale, because I know what a tight budget they had for that, which it was different, you know, with All Good Things, the studio basically said, do whatever you want, let's make this huge. And then with DS9, it was like, we've got to keep this under control, guys. So they didn't have the luxury on What You Leave Behind that they had on All Good Things to just do whatever they needed to do to tell the story. And I think they did a really good job of pulling it all together under really difficult circumstances. I would like to direct you, Ty, and anyone else who's interested in this topic, to Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Speaker. This is a CD series that Larry and I produce each year. And Larry has boxes and boxes and boxes of cassette tapes of interviews that he did over the years with the people who worked behind the scenes, and of course the actors as well. And the one that we did a couple of years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, Volume 3 of Trek Glenn on Speaker is DS9's finale, What They Left Behind. And the idea of these discs is that you get to hear the history of Star Trek through the voices of the people who actually created it. And we put 4 excerpts on the disc, and 2 of them, well, I'll tell you everyone who's on there. Ronald D. Moore is on there, and Ira Stephen Bear is on there. And they're talking about What You Leave Behind. But as it pertains to this question, Dan Curry, visual effects producer, and Gary Hutzel, visual effects supervisor, are both on there as well. And they actually talk about the budget limitations and how they had to manage to get all of these battle scenes into the episode and work within the resources that they had. So it's very interesting to hear from the guys who did it why they made the decisions that they made and what the studio gave them to work with. So I highly recommend that. And you can find that on LarryNemechek.com. If you look over in the left sidebar, you'll see one about Trek Glenn on Speaker. It probably says Volume 4 right now, but if you click, it takes you to a page where they have all of them. So I definitely recommend that.
Yeah, definitely worth it. I have that copy. Really enjoyed listening to that. And if you're a Deep Space Nine fan and just a fan of Star Trek, hearing what it was like to create the finale of Deep Space Nine, it was just... It is sad to hear that it was such an arduous process for them instead of kind of that joyous process for the Next Generation crew where they're just spending boatloads of cash and making a movie-level events and, you know, Deep Space Nine is trying to scrape together, hey, Ira, what kind of change do we got in the couch over there?
Right.
Well, I've got a quarter and a pop-top can opener. anybody else got anything?
That's what it felt like sometimes, right? All right. But thank you, Ty, for your letter. And thank you, everyone, who sent in these letters. When we were getting ready to do this show, we asked in the Babel Conference if anyone had any questions for us. And we did receive about 5 or 6 of them. As it turned out, we have so many questions that were built up in our mail. We're actually going to hold those questions from the Babel Conference for the next Orb of Mail, because we don't want this show to go too long. And in fact, we're going to record another orb right after this one so that we have another one in the can for you guys. So everyone who contacted us through the Babel Conference, please hang on. We'll get to your questions on the next show. And for everyone who wrote in this time, we really appreciate your feedback. And we will definitely try not to let so much time pass between this Orb of Mail and the next one. Although, if you were prophets, you wouldn't care because time would have no meaning for you.
If only that was the case, Chris.
If only, right? All right. Well, answering questions about DS9 is not the only thing we've been doing on Trek FM recently, so here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And I'm saying this in a really good and loving way. Sometimes some things can't be unseen, but there is nothing cooler than Disco Bones. I mean, I know we're supposed to be in the 23rd century somewhere, but that was squarely 1970-something.
Oh, yeah,
sure.
It was perfect.
To the journey!
I think the only thing that we need to propagate in this new Star Trek show, and I feel like what Voyager propagated as well, is work together, become a family, love each other like family, and you'll be able to overcome any kind of obstacle.
And that is exactly what Voyager did.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Every single one of these movies has been good. So the idea that the first time that he's going to make a bad movie, like the one where he's going to drop the ball, is a Star Trek movie written by Simon Pegg, that does not compute.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and many more that we have on Trek FM everywhere you get your podcast. You can find us in iTunes, where we're a featured content provider with Apple. You can also find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, BlackBerry, SoundCloud. You can go to the website. You can stream from the show pages there, download the MP3 files. You'll find us in all the third-party podcast apps as well. I highly recommend Overcast if you're an iOS user. If you're not using that, it's a great application. And if you're on Android, we have good news for you. Finally, after about 5 or 6 months of waiting, Google has launched podcasts in the Google Play Music Store. And it's not a standalone app, as I understand it. I'm not in the US, so it's not available to me, but it's actually in the Google Play Music app. You should be able to search for podcasts now. And I believe they launched that on April 18th. That's what I have heard as the official launch date. They talked about it for about half a year. We set our stuff up about 6 months ago when they first announced it. So we've been ready to go for a long time. We've just been waiting for them. So if you're an Android user, hopefully that will make it easier for you to consume the podcasts now. So go check that out. And let us know if you do subscribe or get the shows that way. I'd like to know how it works. Unfortunately, it is available only to listeners in the United States right now. So hopefully it will be opened up to everyone internationally as well soon. I don't really know why they're limiting that to the US, but that's what the Americans often do for some reason. Okay. Anyway, so yeah, go check out all of those shows. And we have such great content for you every day of the week, about 3 or 4 new podcasts per day for you, 7 days a week. And if you'd like to support those podcasts, we could really use your help keeping it all going. It's very expensive to operate this network. And we have many people who are supporting us through Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll get all the information that you need. And you'll also find out about the perks that we have for you there, including the exclusive patrons website called Patron Zone at patron.zone, where we do some early show releases from time to time. We also have art and ringtones and sometimes video clips and all kinds of other stuff for you that we put up there. So we hope you'll go check it out. patreon.com/trekfm. And we want to thank our associate producers who support us there through Patreon: Ruth Ward, Will Wynn, and Ken Tripp. Of course, Will Wynn is our content manager here on the network, and Ken Tripp you can hear on Standard Orbit these days, our original series show, and he also edits that show. So we really thank Ruth, Will, and Ken for all their support and their help here on the network. Now, Matthew, when you're not helping Rom clean up the mess that the owls made on the promenade, where can people find you?
Well, thanks for sticking me with that job, Chris. but you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me on the network here doing Literary Treks with Dan, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek. We also get the opportunity to interview the authors, which is fantastic. You'll also find me on the 602 Club, which is our general geek show. I really love being there, talking about all of our favorite fandoms outside of Star Trek here on the network. It's so much fun, so please make sure you check that out. And then I do a podcast with my friend John Mills. You can find on iTunes at Aggressive Negotiations, and that is a Star Wars podcast where we talk all about Star Wars and the different things that we love about it, and just dive in a little bit deeper, kind of like we do here on The Orb. Now, Chris, when you're not sitting around trying to get your owl to actually deliver your orb, where can we find you?
Yeah, I know. My owl, he has trouble holding on to the orb, you know, like slipping out of his talons. So we're working on that. But well, before I tell you where you can find me, I do want to tell people if you want to share your feedback about the show itself, you can do that in a number of places. You can go to trek.fm/contact. You can use the form there, choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that'll come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also find us on Twitter at TrekFM is the network name. And you can find us on Facebook. Our main page is facebook.com/TrekFM. And then we have our closed listeners group, which I highly recommend you joining, which is called the Babel Conference. I mentioned it earlier, actually, when I talked about some of the other letters that we had received and questions we had received. On Facebook, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right on up. Click join if you're not yet a member, and we'll let you right on in. We have many, many people there talking about Star Trek all day long, every day. It's a great way to extend the conversation beyond the shows, and we hope to see you over there. Now, as for me, you can find me elsewhere on the network on The Ready Room, which is a show where we talk about all 5 live-action Star Trek series. We actually rotate through those, and we also talk about Star Trek news. I also do the short news show Hyper Channel. And then elsewhere, in terms of Star Trek, you can find my writing on the official website at startrek.com. Just search for my name, C, Brian with a Y, and Jones, and my articles will come up. You can also use that name to find me on Twitter at C, Brian Jones. That's my name there. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb.
All right, so why are we talking about owls? Well, if you're a listener to The Orb, you know that it's time for The Orb of Mail. Because Matthew loves Harry Potter so much, we have our mail delivered by Owl Post here on The Orb. And Rom, because he's the one that gets stuck with the duty, is the one who...
you just said duty.
Sorry, I didn't mean to say that, funny. But yeah, I guess I did, didn't I? So... Anyway, bringing the level of the orb down to an all new low here.
Sorry, guys. Sorry. We've really been away for a long time, you know?
He really wants us to change this, so we'll try to. But for now, we are going to continue on with the owls, who have brought us a lot of mail because...